Blog Talk Radio.
It's the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
Hey, we're back, and it's December 25th, 2021. We're about to finish this year up, and gladly doing so. But I'd like to give special mention to the reason why we have that holiday, and that is to our good friend and fearless leader, King of Kings, David Lynch. Now, Michael, I don't know if you realize the impact David Lynch has had on the Gen X, the millennials, the Zoomers, But David Lynch is the man, and it's the reason why we have a national holiday. I mean, eventually it'll be December 25th will be Lynch Mass. Now, that doesn't sound right. But anyway, the Lynch Who Stole Christmas. That's it. So, yes, this is on the, in the trenches in the war against Christmas. We have instituted David Lynch as our tour de force, if you will. And it was Lynch whose career paralleled Donald J. Trump. And, you know, he started doing things like movies like Eraserhead in the early, you know, by Reagan. But as the decade progressed and we had a name for the late 1980s, it was apocalypse culture. And the Lynchian genre of horror came about, and it was, you know, the perfectly dressed suburban mom laying in the grass with a perfect beehive dead, with maybe a bug in her ear or something. That with a background of a Norman Rockwell background, if you all are with me. Mike, are you with me? Hello.
Oh, yeah. I'm just cracking up in the background. That's all.
Okay. So, yeah, so we're here to launch this war on Christmas in a full-on assault against the military incarceral complex. And it has been brought to our attention, there's 4,100 CEOs profiting from mass incarceration. And so what we're going to do in the next year is we're going to go by the numbers, how this fraud came about, how it operates, and the effects it's had on black, brown, and indigenous communities around the world. And we're going to talk about the telecom companies, how that came about, and how they were using legislation from 1864. You realize the first wire transfers were with the old telegraph machines over in Leavenworth Prison.
Oh, I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, 1860s. So, you know, we're going to be able to talk about some of the big crooks. You know, the big criminals of manifest destiny.
Well,
and,
could I ask you something about this David Lynch, M-A-S, Lynchmas? Out here in the boondocks, we're being bombed with old Dragnet reruns from the 1950s on over-the-air antenna television. And I've always reminded that Christmas is under attack. And, you know, it's a very confusing situation that you would bring up David Lynch. That's the guy that did this TV series called Twin Peaks. Isn't that right, I think?
Yes, yes. And it describes exactly what happened to America once the Reagan administration had 8 years to disassemble liberty and the bare bones of a democracy.
Yeah, I understand the economical part of it. The economics, I get. But the who was the one that had the one about the human ear cut off and laying in the grass? Was that wasn't him, was it? Or that was
Yes, that was Blue Velvet.
Yeah, Blue Velvet, the human ear in a carefully manicured front yard, and the ants are running around the human ear. I've never forgot that after I watched that movie. That's David Lynch. He directed that, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a sick movie.
Oh,
that was a pretty sick movie. I think Dennis Hopper was in it, I think.
Yes.
sucking on a bag of glue or some sort of drugs, and he was a real crazy in that movie too, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think it was laughing gas. I think it was like amyl nitrate or something like that.
I may have some of that here just handy in my studio office, but I'm trying to figure out how this relates to Christmas. I mean, I think this is being taped. There is Twin Peaks replays on Netflix. I think you can watch the complete season. I haven't done it. That's a strange series too. I mean, Blue Velvet was crazy, but Twin Peaks is even weirder. And I haven't yet figured out, it's something about a FBI agent, I think, that goes into this strange town, and he becomes strange himself, and I think he sort of goes crazy over the season. And it has something to do with this woman. I think it's something like, where is Laura Roberts? Laura Palmer.
Yeah. Laura Palmer, she was like a homecoming queen or prom queen or something like that, and she disappears.
Oh.
And so there had been a lot of strange things going on in the area, so it was time, such a high-profile case erupts, and so the FBI's got to put a lid on it.
I'll tell you what, that sounds a lot, you might be on to something there, Carl. Because, I mean, that's an old TV series, just like Blue Velvet, the movie. And now it's like true crime is everywhere. Serial murders are everywhere. It's like it's just nonstop. I mean, the dangerous world we live in and the bizarre nature of it. It's a really strange that's a strange thing that you're bringing up Christmas and David Lynch. I think it's very original. I enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, he could very well be the coming Messiah. And because we don't know. We just don't know. And so why not? Why not it be David Lynch?
Well, I agree. I mean, you think those illiterate people, Gentiles and Jews alike, in 3,000 years ago, I wonder if they knew that this innocent babe in a stable was going to become their next Messiah. I think you're right. You might be onto something there.
Yeah.
In American culture.
Probably,
it could be anything.
Probably some of the listeners have read Robert Graves' I, Claudius, where most of us have just watched the BBC miniseries. But,
correct.
So there was a mention, you know, Augustus Caesar was like, what the hell is going on with all these messiahs in Jerusalem? You know, and it was just the soil, what was explained to me was the soil of Egypt had been depleted. And people are just doing all these creative ways to commit suicide because that's about the only way you are going to be remembered. And so, you know, Augustus couldn't figure it out. It didn't hit Rome that the soil had been depleted in Egypt by then. So, you know, there's similar situations that may be occurring with the fall of Rome, with the United States returning into what Gore Vidal would describe as a second-rate republic, like who is it that's got the borders up right now? Right there, the road between Ethiopia and Rome, Belarus.
Oh, Belarus.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, that's what we're hoping for. Can we be as good as Belarus? Because I'm looking at old drilling pipe, it's like, well, how can I pull my little Ford Focus with a couple goats? It's kind of where I'm at right now. this new year.
Yeah, I have seen those pictures of Vail Roots of guys using their mules to haul their, drag their pickup trucks around. You know, they use livestock to pull the to pull their empty trucks that don't work anymore around. I've seen that. Well, it's 646 for you Trumpers out here in Never Never Land. Area code 646-716-8652 for any of you that like to call in and talk about this latest addition to our holidays. It's called Lynch Mass, David Lynch Mass, in commemoration of the outstanding television and movie director who gave us a new form of horror today. I found a Graber piece. Would you like to take a break? And we'll play this. I think it's Graber. It's number 18, clip number 18.
Sounds good.
Would you like me to play that now?
Yeah, okay. Let it roll.
All right.
I come from the United States, where everybody is taught that democracy, you know, comes from the founding fathers who created the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, Constitution. And, you know, the amazing thing is if you actually look at the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, it doesn't say anything about America being a democracy. No one ever talks about this. And if you look at it, you know, and you figure out why, you read the original documents, you realize that actually those guys hated democracy. They said so all the time. You know, I actually saw the opening speech of the Constitutional Convention, where the people gathered together to create the American Constitution. And the first speech is by Governor of Virginia. He says, we've got a real problem in this country. There's a real danger of democracy breaking out. There's democratic elements in a lot of the local constitutions. We've got to do something about this. What are we going to do to prevent democracy? We need to create a federal system, you know, so forth and so on. So the entire constitutional project is an attempt explicitly to suppress democracy. Now, what do they mean by democracy? Well, they meant this. They meant people sitting around in squares, publicly discussing what to do and brainstorming ideas and resolving their own problems in an equal fashion. And why were they against it? They said very blatantly. I mean, John Adams, I think the third president, said, well, one man, one vote, that's insane. You can't have democracy. We have, you know, we have like 10 million people with no property and 1 million people with property. What do you think is going to happen if you give these guys the vote? You know, they're going to appropriate us right away. So they made very clear that there's no way you can have real democracy if, you know, if you have vast inequalities of wealth without people actually taking, you know, undoing the great inequalities of wealth. Now, what they have done over the last 200 years is figure out a way, A, to take these institutions which were basically created to stop democracy and convince everybody they are democracy, and B, to, like, get people more and more involved in the system, since gradually they did expand it to one man, one vote, and still somehow not have them do the thing everybody was afraid that they were going to do in the beginning, which is appropriate the wealth. It's been one of the, you know, I mean, millions and millions of very ingenious people have been working on how to do this for years. It's one of the greatest pieces of propaganda ever done, but it's ultimately backed up by force. And the moment you really seriously challenge it, well, we all see what happens.
Thank you. And so I just want us all to be aware that we need to acknowledge that the wealth and the deep intelligence and the deep understanding of what true democracy is comes from the native people of what I only call the USA, because you can't call it America, because it's a place of a huge continent.
Yeah, well, I mean, and one thing I would add to that, which people don't acknowledge, is most of the actual democratic elements that did end up in the American constitutional system originally come from Native Americans. I mean, the federal system is borrowed from Native Americans directly. I mean, the story of what actually happened historically has really not been told. Because we have this idea, we have these people who have just always been sort of these native people, that don't have politics of their own. But actually, you know, when European settlers showed up in North America, what they really encountered was the result of hundreds of years of democratic movements within Native American societies. There are these vast kingdoms, you know, in the Mississippian civilization, were called the caste systems, the hierarchical, human sacrifice. Those things were overthrown, and they were overthrown by popular movements, and we're only now beginning to understand that happened within indigenous societies, which then created a remarkably individualistic and egalitarian democratic system. I mean, a lot of the Enlightenment was actually borrowed from Native Americans directly. Yeah.
Technology. Now, while it is true that historically capitalism has coincided with incredible amounts of technological creativity, most of that technological creativity has actually been funded by governments and not come out of private sector at all. And that's actually increasingly true. Or from the third sector, which isn't organized capital. Actually, a lot of primary research is now done neither by government nor by capitalists, but, by NGOs and other cooperatives. But the corporatization and capitalization of research has actually led to a massive decline of technological innovation and growth. It seems to be, as a system, we're seeing capitalism has really come to about its limits in terms of its very ability to provide the thing which had been its major advantage, which was rapid and spectacular technological innovation leading to greater possibilities and prosperity, which allows wealth to be redistributed to a degree where the, you know, that normal tendency for wealth to accumulate, which so many people, most recently Piketty, have observed, could be to some degree undercut. So it seems to me we've got at a period where capitalism has really gone, you know, it had a good historical run, but on every major measure we can find, it's running out of steam. It's no longer able to provide greater equality. It's creating greater inequality. It's no longer able to create technological innovation on anything like the scale it had before. If anything, it seems to be a brace against such innovation. It no longer seems to be able to provide relative levels of peace and security for people. And at exactly the moment where it seems to be failing on all fronts, it seems surprising to me that there is a sudden movement within people who 30 years ago would have been against it to say, well, maybe we can save it from itself. Structural adjustment policies and their effects on various parts of the world. had spent 2 years in Madagascar, and Madagascar had undergone all sorts of IMF structural adjustment over the years with various confusing effects. Some of them were actually kind of ironically quite good, like the state basically sort of pulled up stakes and left a large parts of the countryside because they figured they weren't getting any taxes out of the countryside anyway, and was sort of managing their own affairs completely autonomously, and that was cool. But they also did things like withdraw support for mosquito eradication programs, the idea being IMF would set the terms for debt rescheduling and demand various budget cuts. In this case, there was a program that had been put in 50 years before to wipe out malaria in the highlands, which had been very successful. People had all lost their immunity, but they couldn't afford to keep it up anymore when they had to cut the budget. And as a result, I believe 15,000 people died, 10 or 15, depending on the accounts. The epidemic came back. Everyone had lost their immunity. At least 5,000 of those were children. And this had happened right before I came to Madagascar. A lot of people were actually quite devastated by the experience. And I was telling the story, and she was very sympathetic, and she said, well, yes, but what were you, you know, as an activist, what were you proposing to do about this? And I said, well, we were involved in the Drop the Debt campaign, this thing called Jubilee 2000. So the debt of the Global South should be forgiven. And her reaction was somewhat shocked and mortified. She said, well, they borrowed the money, you know, I mean, surely people have to pay their debts. Somehow the way it was just so commonsensical. And, you know, as an activist, you know, your first reaction when you see this is say, oh, bad conversation, all right. Yeah, I thought this was a friend. Okay, wait, which one do I do? You know, there's like 12 different responses you can do. Do I say, well, they didn't really borrow the money, some dictator who put it in a Swiss bank account? You say, well, actually, they paid this money about 20 times over at this point just through the miracle of compounded interest. You know, they'll never get out. There's a million different responses. Actually, the response I think I came up with thought would be most effective in that context was the economical one, which is, you know, if profits are your reward for taking a risk, well, you're supposed to be taking a risk. So, I mean, the whole point of a financial system is to guide money towards wise investments, and if you have a system like the IMF imposed on most of the world where you're going to get paid back no matter what you do, there's absolutely no incentive to make intelligent loans. But what really struck me was that sort of commonsensical, you have to pay your debts. I mean, I thought, well, this is a very nice person. She just heard a story which involved 7,000 dead babies. What other circumstance would she try to justify killing 7,000 babies? Probably not.
Wow. Justification for killing 7,000 babies. Could you imagine? Could that happen here? What do you think, Mike? I mean, that's Lynchian, right? We got this Norman Rockwell background, this landscape we know as America. I mean, I'm hearing Lee Greenwood ringing in my ears. I'm seeing Nancy Reagan's lips as we speak. Okay? Now put those two together and what you got. Don't say a sandwich with ears and a... Never mind. You know that old joke. What do you get when you cross a peanut butter sandwich with an elephant? I'm assuming this is a Democrat joke. There's something, I mean, you know, the thing about the labor movement, sometimes yeah. they weren't so tender. There were times when the labor movement was a force to be reckoned with. Okay, so, all right, so those who make profit are the heroes, and we've seen this since the McCarthy era, right?
Yeah.
Did you see Nichols' article on It's a Wonderful Life in The Nation?
No, I haven't got to my, I'm still plowing to the last one. I haven't got to the, what did he say about in The Nation? I mean, he's always interesting.
Well, you know, Ayn Rand was an advisor on the House Un-American Activities.
Oh, yeah.
FBI said that, well, you know, we really, you know, the communists make bankers look greedy. That's what Ayn Rand informed him about. So anyway. All right. So we've kind of set up our Norman Rockwell landscape here. And if anybody's driven across Missouri on Interstate 70 or Interstate 44, you can thank Barbara Bush for the hello?
I-94 in Wisconsin. I want to report to your listeners that I-94 in Wisconsin had like, it looked from a drone footage, it appeared to be like a hundred, I don't know, dozens and dozens and dozens of FedEx, semi-trucks, cars, big pileup on I-94 in Wisconsin. Today, I was sending it out to my relatives celebrating Lynch Mass today, Lynchmas, David Lynch Christmas, and asking them if they thought this was the Christmas shopping rush. I haven't received a reply yet, but I tend to think they agree. Oh, you brought up Nichols, and here I do have something here by Flannery O'Connor. I don't know. You brought up Ayn Rand, or A-Y-N Rand, the famous terrible writer. A woman, a writer, Flannery O'Connor. Her name, and it's a woman. Her name is Flannery O'Connor. You may have, trigger those old brain cells of yours, listeners, and you may remember her as a writer. She said, "I hope you don't have friends who recommend Ayn Rand to you. The fiction of Ayn Rand is as low as you can get in fiction. I hope you picked it up off the floor of the subway and threw it in the nearest garbage pail. He makes Mickey Spillane look like Dostoevsky." So says Flannery O'Connor, who I'm sure is dead now. I'm just trying to add to your Lynchmas holiday, Carl. I'm just trying to help out.
Well, thank you, I appreciate that that you mentioned. You know, these greedy bastards are a part of this horror that we're confronted with every day. And they're CEOs,
yes.
They're chief information officers, they're Wall Street bankers. And all this shit ran to Wall Street. It all ran downhill. This whole trickle-down economics ended up, this whole Reagan experiment. And Reagan, I can't apologize for Reagan simply because coming from Illinois, I know how some of those folks could be, so I'm not surprised that, you know, if only Nixon could go to China, only Reagan could bring about neoliberalism.
That's neoliberalism, right?
So we got this story, this clip, and it's number 29. And so we've got a young buck, a first-term state representative over by O'Fallon, Missouri. It's Montgomery County, and the county seat is Montgomery City.
Oh, God.
And
the number. Here we go.
This is the Abolition Hour.
Wait.
I'm Carl G. This is from the Kansas City Star. Cutting welfare over truancy only dig Missouri families deeper into poverty. Kansas City Star Editorial Board, December 22nd, 2021. Parents do bear some responsibility for making sure their children get to school. But a proposal by a Missouri legislator to cut government assistance to families whose children miss too many days is not the right solution to solve chronic attendance problems in some districts, including Kansas City. State Rep. Jeff Porter, a Montgomery City Republican, has filed what he calls a parent accountability bill that would slash up to 35% of family government assistance for 6 months when their K-12 students does not attend school at least 90% of the time. Porter told the Missouri Net News this week that he believes the legislation would be a win-win for everybody, except, of course, for their struggling families already burdened with the many hardships of poverty. 6 months without benefits could devastate a family already in financial distress. We think such legislation unfairly punishes an entire family for the actions of a child. Teens skip school all the the time, and parents have no idea it's happening. Kansas City Public Schools officials said district attendance issues are not necessarily due to a lack of parental responsibility. It's a lack of stable housing, a lack of resources, and so many other community-related issues, including violence, said Kelly Wackell, district spokesman. Oftentimes, a child's chronic absence are tied to a family poverty. Staying home to look after younger siblings while parents work or are working themselves to supplement household income, stripping the family of resources they receive to ease the burden of poverty would only make the problem worse, not better. Of course, children need to be in school, and persistent truancy is not acceptable, but Missouri needs to focus on a plan that addresses all chronically truant students, not just target struggling families. The punishment for missing school should not be to make money from the family, which could then cause them to miss rent payments or pay for doctor visits. Porter's legislation would not take away food stamps. The Missouri Department of Elementary and Secondary Education requires schools to have 90% of their students in school 90% of the time to get full credit for attendance. Once the criteria measured annually by the state and tied to state accreditation, about 82% of Missouri's K-12 public school children attend school 90% of the time. More than once, poor student attendance has stood in the way of Kansas City Public Schools scoring a range to regain state accreditation. It lost status in 2011. Linking welfare benefits to student attendance is not a new concept. Michigan made this move in 2019 despite pushback from advocates for families in poverty who protested the struggling parents were being singled out and punished for things that children of more affluent parents do all the time. The Michigan Department of Education did not respond to the calls from the STAR to learn whether the restrictions on government assistance has actually worked to improve attendance. Some districts in the Kansas City area have tried incentive programs to encourage students to more regularly show up to school. Raytown Schools offer students a chance to toss their name into an end-of-the-year raffle for a brand new car every month they are in school 95% of the time. Porter's proposal may be well-intended, but as a solution, it's flawed. Legislators who continue trying to pass legislation that directly impact areas like Kansas City and St. Louis with no connection to our understanding of what is happening in those areas only hurt, and it's absurd, Wackell said. In Missouri, legislators really want to help districts solve poor attendance problems, talk to more district leaders, urban and rural, and attack the causes in those areas with solutions that benefit all students and don't punish the poor. This is the Abolition Hour. I'm Carl G.
All right, so we got we got a new state representative. He's quite a young buck if you look at some of the legislation he's trying to get introduced. Quite ambition. A man with an eye for ambition. Experienced businessman. It's going to take Montgomery County into the 22nd century. And how are they going to do that?
What?
Well, as you may have noticed, Missouri has 117 counties. Now, not all these counties can afford county jails, right? As we know, even in Kansas City, we had 18 Wobblies die of pneumonia one year in 1916. So we can't have a bunch of these poor people around the state of Missouri dying of pneumonia. So we're getting places like Warrensburg and Springfield and Jackson County. They want to build multi-purpose facilities. So all these poor counties who can't afford, all they got to do is pay $100 a day to keep their poor white, black and brown and indigenous folks. It's a bargain. If anybody's ever said in a city hall meeting, it's been brought up, what are we going to do with either not enough prisoners or what are we going to do with the cost of shipping prisoners all the way to Warrensburg, as the case in Kansas City? So building a new prison, and we've got one of the national leaders, number one, in prison construction. Actually, we got two. One's called HOK down at Crossroads, and the other is Clark's Construction. You might see them at all these bridges that have been built out here on 435. And so they've built, you know, between the two of them, they've built 400 or 500 prisons. So I'm looking at Montgomery County and this young buck representative with all this ambition, you know. I can see him just eating a sack of oats, right, you know, as I'm listening to this article. And I realized, it's like, okay, we've got 20 counties out of 117 counties show any sign of growth or opportunity. And these areas are St. Louis, Springfield, Missouri, Columbia, Missouri, and Kansas City, the Kansas City Metro. Everything else is a vast wasteland. And these bucks are coming through, and they're setting up shop. And so we got a county of 10,000 people, and so I go to the website, and it says, oh, we have resources to a labor force of 161,000. And I'm like, wow. You know, they've got water. They can run sewage. There's plenty of places to dump pollution out there in Montgomery County. Just drop it, you know. It won't affect wine country. And so, you know, so I'm thinking, like, well, where is this 161,000? You know, because I'm looking at O'Fallon, and I'm looking at St. Charles. And then you start looking at, you know, some of the depopulation, and St. Louis County is actually one of the largest counties depopulating. I mean, it's under 10%, but it's been substantial, where St. Louis was the number fifth population in the state in 1950, and population has dropped in half. Now, never mind that the largest population of educated people are in St. Louis because of St. Louis University and Washington University. Okay, so you got the most learned people right there in that little concentrated area. Okay, a lot of them live in St. Charles. Some of them might even be over there in O'Fallon, okay? But, you know, just go to the website. Go to Montgomery City website or Montgomery City or Montgomery County, and there's absolutely nothing on their calendar of events. You go to, you know, you go 20 miles away to O'Fallon, and it's like, wow. It's like the Wizard of Oz. It starts out in black and white, and all of a sudden she's in Oz, and it's in color. It's just this kind of thing. I mean, you got the Norman Rockwell out there. But now you start getting in these counties where the population is shrinking, like Montgomery County is shrinking. It's at 4%. So it peaked right after World War II, when the soldiers came home. That's when the most houses were built there. But now we've got this young buck saying, hey, we're gonna start taking food out of these kids' mouth. Oh, no, we're not going to take the food out of the kids' mouth, but we're going to take pre-K, we're going to take medical exams, whatever procedures that a young starving child might need. We're going to yank that from them. And if they don't like that, we'll throw their ass in jail in the fourth grade. This is the issue I have with this buck in the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, pardon me?
What is this thing about truancy? I mean, they're going to jail? What? This is crazy.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, so Buck Potter, we're going to take a look at Buck Potter, and we're going to use his county as an example why mass incarceration is the worst idea that's come up since P.T. Barnum and the Bearded Lady. It's Christmas.
It is Lynchmas. Yeah, that's right.
So,
It is Lynchmas.
All right, so anyway, the article just bothered me terribly, because the House is in session, or House is in vacation. They're all out in Napa Valley. So, and we're getting this. And so he's like out the door. You can just see, I mean, you know, this guy, we're going to enjoy watching this guy fall. The going up is worth the coming down, Buck Potter. And we're going to celebrate the next Lynchmas with your demise. So tell your wife, tell your kids, it's going to be a rocky, rocky political career for Buck Potter. Now, so we kind of go, okay, so do we all understand how many starving children there are in Missouri and Kansas? Probably close to a million. We've got the highest teen suicide in the country. Okay? And this state rep Potter wants to discipline all these children for being poor, which probably, likely, their closest relatives are locked up in the Missouri Department of corrections. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit later how many prisons are around there that can supply 161,000 people. I mean, I don't know if we had, when TWA was cranking out there at Lambert Field, do you think they had 100,000, 160,000 employees out there?
No.
Yeah, so these guys have this pie in the sky notion that they're gonna turn this county around. It's only 20 miles out from St. Charles, and we got plenty of water and fresh air. So who is? Let's look at the people who are moving there. It's surely not young women. I guarantee you that. That's probably about 35% of the population, or between 20 to 45. So women are like, ain't no way in hell I'm sticking around in Montgomery County. And I can show you 90 other counties in Missouri that women are saying, ain't no way in hell I'm sticking around this podunk county. Whether it's the one that Sheriff Governor Parsons came out of, or even Greene County. Who the hell? I know people in Greene County are damn glad to be the hell out of there. And when you talk about the spread of...
That's going on. That's all over Western Kansas right now, and really, it's everywhere. Anywhere in the quote unquote rural areas. I mean, people they just leave. It's like screw this. You know, I'm with you, Carl. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No. But that's kind of our point. What's going on in Kansas and Missouri right now very much affects the rest of the nation. And people, you know, that's kind of the purpose of our show. It's like, okay, we got a couple states here. There's only 6 million here and, 4 million there. And so it's easy to kind of sort how these backwood corrupt officials operate with mass incarceration. And now that we've seen this factory in Kentucky get knocked over by a cyclone, okay, and we know there were prisoners working in that factory that were killed, and we cannot find out because there's a morgue at the prison they were assigned to, and they go back to the Kentucky Department of Corrections for the autopsy. So we don't know how. So we don't have a body count yet. Okay. Now, a prison. So anyway, the story I'm getting ready. Let's go ahead and go and play number 30, and we'll look a little bit more into Mayfield because.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mass incarceration. Mass incarceration in these rural areas. We have to look at because they're bringing urban Black, Brown, Indigenous people from the cities and providing jobs in these rural areas. So it doesn't matter how the House of Representatives of that state drafted up policy and procedure, the policy and procedure is written by corporations through ALEC, American Legislative Exchange. Okay.
ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Commission. They're fucking creeps. Here's the clip 30.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. This is from TheIndependent.com from the UK. An escaped inmate, injuries, death, and no idea who foots the bill inside the Kentucky factory flattened by a tornado. This is written by Josh Marcus. Francisco Stark thought a prison work release program would give him a second chance. Then a historic tornado struck Mayfield, Kentucky candle factory, where he works, putting him in legal and physical jeopardy. Francisco Starks, a 44-year-old incarcerated person in Kentucky, was working inside a candle factory in the city of Mayfield when a historic December tornado hit, burying him and over 100 of his coworkers. At least 8 people died in the collapse. Starks was trapped under the rubble, but can't remember how long, just the sounds of one of his colleagues losing consciousness and dying next to him. Then authorities accused Starks of trying to escape custody at the hospital, where he was being treated for injuries to his neck, back, and legs. The next day, it's all over the news and the internet that he escaped. His lawyer, Madison Leach, told The Independent, he called me and he's like, "Maddie, I didn't try to escape. They took me to the hospital and then I didn't know where to go. I'm on crutches and leaving the hospital in pain. There's nobody to pick me up. I don't have a phone. I didn't know what to do." Starks, 44, sought shelter with his daughter, who lives in the area, before returning to jail. Now he's facing potential criminal charges as well as prospect of costly medical bills due to his place in the shadowy world of prison work programs. He's one of the lucky ones. More than 500,000 inmates across the U.S. work while behind bars for subminimum wage, performing the services essential to running a prison, like cooking and cleaning. Roughly 63,000 of those workers make a huge variety of goods that are then sold to both government agencies and major companies. The industrial output of prisons is estimated to run more than $1 billion each year. And in the Wild West world of practically non-existent worker protections, most don't even have a meager guarantee, Starks did. Unlike many prison laborers who often make less than a dollar an hour, Starks earned a wage comparable to someone to the free world. Officials who run the work release program in Graves County, Kentucky, didn't respond to requests. Comment from The Independent, and don't publicly disclose inmates' wages. Starks was making $8 an hour when the tornado hit, according to his lawyer, more than Kentucky's minimum wage. The county deducted at least $15 a day for those wages, according to Ms. Leach, but still a nearly regular wage and the prospect of a job after getting out are rare commodities to people behind bars. Unlike many prison laborers, Starks enjoyed his job too and had supervisors who were kind to him, according to his family. He said he loved it there. His daughter, Brooklyn Starks, told The Independent he loved the people there. The tornado struck during the first week of the job. He was part of a cohort of seven state inmates in a work release program in partnership with the Mayville Consumer Products Factory, a major employer in the town of 10,000, which makes candles for companies like Costco, Victoria's Secret. Robert Daniel, the deputy jailer who supervised him, died trying to get the inmates to safety in the factory. The last thing he did was making sure that inmates were taken care of, even at his own peril, County Jailer George Workman told the Washington Post. It was obvious during the interview process Robert was someone concerned about helping others and doing the right thing for his community. Despite all these attentions, all was well at the factory, according to workers there. Workers were called onto the factory line even as it was clear a historic storm was approaching. The plant was going 24/7 to meet holiday demand, according to Congressman James Corner, who represents the area. Workers were ushered in and out of the emergency shelter areas throughout the evening until the tornado hit. Not everyone was able to make it back of harm's way before tragedy struck. At least five workers in the factories said they were threatened with firing if they left early, which the company denies. The state is now investigating what happened at the factory. Bob Ferguson, a spokesperson, told NBC that the investigation is entirely appropriate and that a state official was given a tour to the factory while denying wrongdoing. "We've had a policy in place since COVID began. Employees can leave at any time they want to leave, and they can come back the next day." The Independent has reached the Mayfield Consumer Products for comment. Stephanie Fisk, Brooklyn Starks' mother, also works at Mayfield and said the factory where Francisco Starks was working was old and not stable to begin with, even before the tornado, which leveled large parts of the town. "If they come in here and inspect this place, everybody's going to be in trouble. They've got wires. You're tripping over stuff." Records reviewed by the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting indicated that Mayfield Factory had an above-average rate of injuries on the factory floor and was fined $16,000 by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration for violations found during the 2019 inspection. The company contested the violations and said it complies with all federal standards. Starks, a state inmate housed at a county facility working for a private company, is now unsure of who will foot the bill for his extensive injuries. By law, incarcerated people don't practically have any workplace protection and are not allowed union rights, even though they often do the exact same kind of work as free people who have these guarantees. If Starks has to put up money himself, he won't be able to pay, leaving him in debt and in jail, even though he had a job, according to his family. "He's out of income, but he's also incarcerated. Put the inmates in that kind of jeopardy in the middle of a storm, then they have no recourse. They can't sue for negligence. They're not making money." Ms. Leach's attorney said, "There's a lot of money going around with these companies. Yet now that he's hurt, I don't even know who's going to pick up the tab." The Kentucky Department of Corrections asked the local jail about Stark's medical treatment, and the Graves County Jail and Mayfield Consumer Products had not responded to requests for comment from the Independent and the Work Release Program. Subpar working conditions and legal recourse are both common factors of incarcerated labor, according to experts. Beginning in 1979, under the initiative called the Prison Industry Enhancement Certification Program, the federal government has certified quality private companies to use inmate labor. Under these arrangements, companies in industries ranging from animal husbandry to call centers to electric manufacturing can pay below minimum wage without offering the jail worker union or OSHA protections. The Kentucky Department of Corrections said to ask local jail about in the early 2000s after being arrested at a peaceful protest in Georgia at the School of the Americas, a notorious now shuttered U.S. military facility accused of training numerous Latin American dictators and war criminals. Inside the federal prison in Pekin, Illinois, female inmates under the watch of armed, mostly male guards manufacture cages to be used to detain migrants in the U.S. border. Ms. Ryerson said she's paid 12 cents an hour to drive a forklift that lifted scrap metal, and she began thinking of her time and how many hours it would take to afford tampons at the prison store, since the facility didn't provide them to inmates. As a prison worker, your boss is guard. Instead of having a regular boss-employee relation, your direct supervisor carries a gun and can impact every aspect of your life, she said. It just filters through everything the normal employer in a reasonable workplace with appropriate labor protections would have. That was set up from the beginning to have a lot of abuse of power, and I absolutely saw that myself. These dynamics can become more acute during the coronavirus pandemic. Inmates are doing vital work and are facing greater risk than the general population for doing so, all with less protections. Incarcerated people have dug mass graves in New York, washed hospital laundry in Oregon, and manufactured hand sanitizer in at least 20 states. Prisons, often cramped and poorly ventilated, were also home of some of the worst COVID outbreaks in the country. A Stanford University study found that COVID spread faster in prisons than on a cruise ship, and prison laborers circulating through various parts of facilities each day to do their jobs come into often more contact with people than the average prisoner. It's a situation that suggests, according to Professor Dolovic, just how much prisons and the broader economy could be viewed as relying on the incarcerated to stay afloat and remain financially viable. They are essential workers in a multiple sense of the word. When you think about how many people are incarcerated in the U.S., then you start to say, well, maybe some of the dynamics of incarceration are that it creates a captive labor force that are necessary to keep private industry and even the public industry of the prison below cost. This is the kind of thing you might argue. Back in Mayfield, even the non-incarcerated aren't sure they're going back to the work of the candle factory. Why did you have us coming into work when you knew the weather was going to be bad, said Stephanie Fick. The company said it was going to pay her a $1,000 bonus from its tornado relief fund, but that still might not be enough to convict her to keep working there. She's still making up her mind. But all around the country, factories that rely on inmate labor will continue to hum along despite the COVID crisis, the climate crisis, and everything else. For many of us, it's a deal too good to pass up. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
All right. Prison labor in Kentucky.
Jesus.
Climate change comes down hard on the mass incarceration corporations and CEOs in one fell swoop. All of a sudden, all eyes are on mass incarceration this holiday. I'm telling you, not even David Lynch came close to seeing this coming this soon. There are 4,100 CEOs that are making millions per year in their pocket by oppressing black and brown, indigenous, and poor people in the United States, and they've exported it across the world. And it comes right home to Kansas City, folks. Kelly came out of the FBI, started electronic policing, computerized policing, in the early 70s. Kansas City police, after they dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, made in Kansas City, went to Japan and set up the first state police, went around to 52 other countries around the world setting up state police. Out here, Kansas City, first black man to become a lieutenant in the Kansas City Police Department was killed. The shotgun that he was killed with was at the armory of the KCP police department and used for 40 years before they discovered they had the freaking crime weapon in their inventory. So how can you say there's such a thing as professional policing? Just look at the Kansas City Police Department. Now, where are we? Should we do another clip?
We're on a musical month.
Good evening, class. Tonight's subject comes from a time in American history that scarcely resembles our own. You see, among other things, the weather was acting real funny. It hurt the crops. The small farmer was out on his own, not doing too well. The government was so deep in the pockets of Wall Street investment bankers that there was a housing crisis and a mass migration. Yes, a remote time indeed. But not all things are all bad or all good. And at the risk of spinning this into a didactic yarn, let us examine an anthropological subset that occurred as a result of these hard times. So now when you're farming on your share and you lose everything you got, and all you have is your two shoes, if you're lucky pants and a shirt, if the banker didn't ask you to take it off your back as you were walking out the door, well then you had to improvise, find new means of public transportation. And that's just what the hobo did. Short footnote here. To find out about the hobo's rail riding lives, it's good to consult Professor Woody Guthrie. Song Hobo's Lullaby. If you need further instruction on just what a hobo is, their sorts and condition, consult your IWW glossary. I'll give you time. Right next to Das Kapital, top shelf. All right. Now these hobos weren't just rail riding, thieving ne'er-do-wells. Not all of them, at least. And within this culture, they built a system of language, code of ethics and honor, even a hieroglyphic system of writing. Why, to this day, if you live in an older house somewhere in middle America, somewhere between Oklahoma and California, you can probably go out and look out on the fence post, find out how the previous owner treated people, whether he was a good Christian, an honest man, a plain dealer. Street investor, hedge fund manager, lion sack of shit, as it were. And last but not least, in this little intercourse, it's been good for me. The hobo developed his own mythological structure and system. And that is the subject of tonight's song. comes out of the Hobo Hymnal, page 39.
Praise the Lord.
Given the way things are going, I think we could all use a little old-time religion now, Dennis. Some might stipulate that the place I'm going to sing about right now actually exists. About 6 miles due west of Cimarron, New Mexico. Well, I don't know all about that. They wouldn't let me in because the Boy Scouts of America own it. But I'll keep looking. And one evening as the sun went down, the jungle fire was burning. Down the track came a hobo hiking. He said, boys, I ain't turning. I'm headed for the land far away beyond the crystal fountains. So come with me and we'll go see Big Rock Candy Mountain. Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain is a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars are all empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees and the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, all the cops have wooden legs and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth and a hen lays soft-boiled legs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall and the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, all the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. Ain't no shorthand shovels, no axes, saws, no picks. Well, I'm going the way where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work. I'll see y'all next coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Give us
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. This is from the San Francisco Bayview National Black Newspaper, December 14th, 2021. Have we normalized the genocidal practice of caging our youth? The themes of letters we receive are often painful, but none as painful as genocidal incarceration of our youth. Children subjected to torture, a solitary confinement. Children given death sentences of various kinds. Children sentenced to adult prisons. Our children. Locking them up at 14 for nonviolent cost me a whole life of freedom. By Robert Clark. And this was December 14th, 2021. My name is Robert Clark. I am currently in prison in the state of Kansas. I got locked up when I was 13 years old. The year was 1968. I was sentenced to a school for boys for the charge of vandalism. My sentence was only 4 months, but little did I know I'd never be free again. When I arrived at this youth prison, I had some adjustment problems, which eventually led to me to a max security prison in Lincoln, Nebraska, at the age of 14. As a scared youngster, I parlayed a four-month sentence into a 220 years for a series of assaults for the charge of vandalism. When you're that young in the adult prison, you had to fight for your life and honor. I've been locked up 53 years because of this. I'm 66 years old now. I've never had a relationship with a female, never been in a mall, never been fishing. Never had a car. I've never done anything in society. Hope my story will reach out to anyone out there that thinks the petty crime that they're committing in society does not matter. It really does. I was locked up for nonviolence, but in the end costing me my whole life. After years of violence and solitary confinement, I was transferred to the state of Kansas. Hope no one makes this mistake that I made. Send a brother some love and light. Robert Clark, 44032, Norton Correctional Facility, P.O. Box 546, Norton, Kansas, 67654. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
All right. I want everybody to write letters to prisoners this year. It's the only way we can fight back against the injustice and the evil. We got to let those prisoners know, got to let those prison warden know that we're keeping an eye prisoners, and we care about their treatment, their custody, and we want their release. And we'll talk about release later. Now, Mike, I got another one that's a part two is number 27, and if you want to cue that, we'll talk about number 26. Clip 26. It's about women's prisons and conditions that women have to go through, And the quiz today is how to make a jailhouse tampon. I was just checking to see if anybody in the other room was listening. I would have heard a chuckle out of that.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. We are a nation that prosecutes children as adults, yet displays an appalling lack of interest in protecting them. By Tasha Brown. San Francisco Bayview, December 14th, 2021. Prisoner. That term evokes a painful dualism of feelings. As an individual who has violated the law, I fully comprehend that my incarceration is a consequence. After nearly 19 years behind the blockade of brick and razor wire, I've had a tremendous opportunity for growth. My commitment offense occurred when I was 15. I was sentenced to 37 years to life, life that is an indisputable performance to it. We are a nation that prosecutes children as adults yet displays an appalling lack of interest in protecting them. Of the 2 million plus people in the U.S. penal facility, over 60% were sexually abused as children. The abuse began as a precursor, of course. Does not absolve offending behavior, yet arbitrary laws and mandatory minimums in sentencing disregard this factor. We've heard it before, school-to-prison pipeline. What we don't hear is that the racist policies are strategically woven into our education system, which creates fundamental inequalities. Impoverished children dodge bullets and bullies to make it in an underfunded school to receive a substandard education. Adolescence is a stressful time as it is. Add to the equation the compounded challenges of children in marginalized communities. 22% of the children in the U.S. still live in poverty. The conditions no doubt propel these children into conveyor belts of the criminal justice system. It is called affluenza. It's called affluenza when a privileged child commits a crime to negate consequences. Poverty itself is criminalized, so the impoverished receive a politicized form of justice, a rendition of lynching, institutional lynching. Mainstream media, with its fear-mongering approach to reporting, does not properly contextualize black and brown crime. The public relies on the outlets for news, but what passes for news has a doctrinal slant. News like the Tulsa race massacre gets suppressed, as off-putting as black bodies littering the streets. It's a truth. Truth is rich and poor people live in a parallel universe. Truth is mass incarceration has roots in black codes. Truth is police brutality has roots in slave catchers making an example of runaway slaves. I keep hearing racial reckoning. Can there really be a racial reckoning when the criminal justice system is reinstituting slavery through mass incarceration, the 13th Amendment? Until there is a racial transformation of the system that is predicated on slave labor, all discourse rings hollow. Nuances of language scratches itching ears, yet produces no meaningful change. 22% of the U.S. still live in poverty. And due to systemic race discrimination, a disproportionate number of prisoners come from poverty. Further, 90% of persons in prison for drug offenses are of color and exacerbates disenfranchisement. An adolescent offender deemed a throwaway to society, too many to purchase cigarettes or alcohol, obtain a driver's permit, vote, consent to sex, or sign legally binding contracts, but too young to be prosecuted as an adult and sentenced to civil death in prisons seems a flagrant violation. A violation egregious as discrimination by race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, political affiliation, physical challenges, and even a felony conviction. Capacity to change is within us all. The season is ripe. Don't let the fruit be simply another artificial high. Equality for all. Send our sister some love and light. Tasha Brown, X08560, CCWF 506-08-03L. Chowchilla, California, 93610. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
All right. I have to give it to the San Francisco Bay View. They really do a good job with their prison writers and editorials. And you can go to that website, and there's a half a century of prison news. And we highly recommend y'all check out the San Francisco Bay View and even make a contribution. And we're quite grateful of all the work they do in the prison abolition movement. Now, I got another clip, number 22. There's a situation, I don't know if y'all remember Antifa. We got kind of caught up in the David Lynchian thing, the Lynchian Christmas. But there's some kind of weird situation the prosecutor has going on in San Diego about prosecuting about seven Antifa, Pacific Beach, Huntington Beach. So I think it might be called the Pacific Beach Seven or something like this. But there's some reminiscence of the Sacco and Vizzetti case, which happened around 1927, where they were executed, but it's basically the same kind of charges that possibly could be developing against this Pacific Beach 7. And so I don't remember when I heard about it. Now, so I read it, found it about the 11th, so the second week of December is when the story came out, and I think there's a list of charges. But around January 9th, there was a MAGA rally around Huntington Beach, around San Diego, Huntington Beach area, on the Pacific Beach. And so there was some pepper spray. There was some scuffs, and maybe somebody was checked out the hospital, but it's just kind of an odd, it's kind of just an odd situation. And this is something that we see in direct action, where you get a group of folks and a bit of a feedback loop may begin. And all of a sudden they decide on maybe a Saturday morning at 3 a.m. that, hey, let's call an action. And this being 5 days after January 6th, or 4 days, 3 days, it's just not the regular organized, what local organizers, it's not exactly how they put together an action. And so the prosecutor now is saying, oh, well, this is Antifa. This has Antifa all over it. They have, black bowling shirts on or something, is their rationale. But this article, clip number 22, actually talks about what is going on with the prosecutor down in San Diego County. And we'll go ahead and follow up after that. I'll give you that number when we finish. But this is an interesting
abolitionist
story.
Hour. I'm Carl G. Experts say San Diego case likely first to use conspiracy charges against Antifa. San Diego Union Tribune, October 11, 2021, Alex Riggin reporting. When San Diego prosecutors charged a group of individuals this week with conspiracy to commit the crime of riot, it was believed by experts who studied domestic extremism to be the first time nationwide that a conspiracy charges has been used specifically to prosecute alleged anti-fascists and or supporters, as prosecutors described them. The charges stem from the January 9th Patriot March in Pacific Beach, California, which was organized in support of the President Donald Trump and came just 3 days after his supporters had stormed the U.S. Capitol. In response to the rally, dozens of black-clad anti-fascists showed up on the boardwalk and streets near Crystal Pier to counter-protest. Throughout the Saturday afternoon, violence broke out several times, often between the counter-protesters and the pro-Trump group. At least five people who had been at the Capitol 3 days earlier, according to reporting by The Appeal, and between counter-protesters and police officers. Videos also show members of the pro-Trump group attacking a barefoot man, a Trump supporter throwing munition canisters at the counter-protesters, and anti-fascists attacking people, including pepper spraying an apparent bystander walking at. Those charges in San Diego Superior Court case, which includes at least 11 defendants, each face an array of their own separate charges, as well as the shared conspiracy charge. Their alleged crime includes assault with a deadly weapon other than a firearm, assault likely to produce great bodily injury, animal cruelty, vandalism, and the use of tear gas, not for self-defense. I'm not aware of other cases like this where a group of Antifa supporters are charged together as committing a conspiracy, Katrina Dalser, and associate fellow for the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said in a Tuesday phone interview. Individuals who self-identify as anti-fascist activists or who prosecutors describe as members of supporters of Antifa have been charged in courtrooms across the country, particularly in the past year and a half. But Doxey said those cases, often involving offenses such as rioting, civil disobedience, or arson, typically include just one defendant and have not, to her knowledge, involved conspiracy allegations. I'll be interested to see more documents that come from the court case, Doxey said, adding that although she's an attorney, she believes prosecutors will have a heavy burden of proof to show the defendants went to Pacific Beach specifically intending to commit violence. Seamus Hughes, an expert in federal court system outline database, said there hasn't been a federal conspiracy charge leveled against self-described anti-fascists. It's fair to say in this case is both unique in its prosecution and its charges, Hughes, deputy director of George Washington University Program on Extremism, wrote in an email. The DOJ has flirted with a charge in the past, meaning that they've used the possible investigation that charge to secure federal search warrants against self-described Antifa members, ultimately did not bring criminal charges. The rise of Antifa. The history of anti-fascist movement dates back to the period between the First and Second World War, when left-wing groups banded together to fight rising fascism in Germany, Italy, England, and elsewhere in Europe. According to Doxey, one of the most common symbols used by modern anti-fascists features black and red flags that are typically inside a circle, ringed with the words anti-fascist action. According to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the symbol represents the red flag of the 1917 Russian Revolution and the black flag of the 19th century anarchists. Anti-fascist movement generally quieted down after the defeat of Nazi Germany, but it reemerged in the 1970s in response to the rise in neo-Nazi activity, according to a report Doxey co-wrote and researched. She said there's a low simmer of activity in the decades that followed, but the anti-fascist movement emerged from the shadows for most casual observers over the past 5 years or so, particularly during and following the campaign and election of Donald Trump.
Many Americans first heard of Antifa in August 2017, when counter-protests, many of them who were self-described anti-fascists, squared off at right-wing hate groups and white supremacists at the Unite the Night rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was after killing George Floyd in May 2020 as protests raged across the country that Trump tweeted, "The United States of America will be designating Antifa as a terrorist organization." Trump never followed through on that promise. And the FBI Director Christopher Wray testified to Congress that Antifa was more of an ideology than an organization. The historian Mark Bray, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, likened the movement to feminism. There are feminist groups, but feminism itself is not a group, Bray told NPR earlier this year. Similarly, there are Antifa groups, but Antifa itself is not a group. It's a way of doing politics to oppose the far right. It's the kind of ideology or political tendency that any group of people can put together into action. There's no chain of command. In June 2020 report, the Congressional Research Service described the U.S. Antifa movement as decentralized, consisting of independent, radical, like-minded groups and individuals. Some anti-fascists echo the principles of anarchism, socialism, and communism. And among other things, many also support environmentalism, the rights to indigenous populations, and gay rights. It's decentralized, leaderless nature of Antifa that makes the conspiracy charge in the Pacific Beach case so rare. Conspiracy to riot and direct action. Pedro Gerson is an assistant professor who teaches criminal law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. He said conspiracy charge is probably one of the most treasured weapons in the arsenal of prosecutors. A defendant convicted of conspiracy, Gerson said, can be punished for more serious offenses committed by co-conspirators. It is a way to tie everyone up together, which is why prosecutors like it, Gerson said. Calling it a pressuring tool prosecutors can use to get defendants to plead to other charges, or in some cases, flip a defendant against others and her co-defendants. It's a very powerful tool. Gerson said the prosecution must prove two things in a criminal conspiracy case, that there was an agreement and the overt acts were committed. The criminal complaint against the alleged Pacific Antifa group lists 68 overt acts, which include seemingly innocuous actions like dressing in or gathering black clothing, but also kicking victims, spraying victims with mace, pushing victims to the ground, and striking the victims with flagpoles and walking sticks. Prosecutors allege that other aspects of the criminal conspiracy, the agreement was ratified by the defendants on social media or simply through their presence at the designated time and location of the counter-protest. Defendants allegedly pledged their support and participation by liking and sharing a January 2nd social media post that called for counter-protesting and direct action. The complaint states, by liking and sharing the post, the defendants in essence agree to take part of the direct action. Gerson said the district attorney's definition of direct action appears to be key to proving the agreement, and thus the conspiracy. In the complaint, prosecutors define direct action as a tactic known to mean acts of violence such as assault, battery, assault with deadly weapons, arson, and vandalism. The complaint alleges the object of the conspiracy was to incite and participate in a riot using direct action tactics. But left-wing definition and direct action appears much broader. One anarchist leaflet, for example, describes direct action as including blockades, pickets, sabotage, squatting, tree spiking, lockouts, occupations, rolling strikes, slowdowns, the Revolutionary General Strike. It's also included organizing food co-ops and mutual aid, or essentially any action that removes the need for elected leaders, businesses, or even non-governmental organizations. There's more to direct action than responding to injustices or threats by the state. The anarchist leaflet states, any situation where people organize to extend control over their own circumstances without recourse to capital or state constitutes direct action. Doing it ourselves is the essence of direct action, and it does not matter whether what we are doing is resisting injustice or attempting to create a better world now by organizing to meet our own social needs. Gerson said the criminal complaint uses direct action as a code word for violence, and the prosecutor appeared to allege the defendants conspired to do direct action, so they conspired to commit violence. Gerson, who is not involved in the case, said he would, as a defense attorney, likely attack the government's argument that he alleged co-conspirators agreed to advance to commit violence, and would argue that the defendants only agreed to protest and protect themselves if needed. Attorneys for the defendants could not reach for comment this week, and warrants and other documents in the case were sealed by a judge. A unique charge, but not a unique case. Though a conspiracy charge against Antifa is novel, there have been cases with similarities before. In 2017, more than 200 demonstrators, including most anti-fascists, as well as journalists, legal observers, and medics, were arrested and charged in connection to vandalism that occurred in Washington, D.C. during demonstrations against Trump's January 20th inauguration, also known as J20. Some defendants in the so-called J20 case faced federal conspiracy to riot charges, and most faced other novel prosecutorial argument, meaning group liability. Prosecutors argued that anyone near the criminal behavior when it happened could be held liable for those crimes, even if they didn't cause the destruction themselves. Though some J20 defendants took plea deals, prosecutors eventually dropped the majority of the cases. The conspiracy count that were charged were not specifically aimed at anti-fascist or any ideological group. In 2020, long before Antifa captured the public's attention, at least 18 self-described anti-racist activists stormed into a restaurant in Chicago suburbs and attacked a white supremacist meetup. Five of the attackers, Indiana residents who 6 months earlier had found the Hoosier anti-racist movement, were arrested as they fled, according to Mother Jones. Their case came to be known as the Tinley Park Five. The Cook County State's attorney did not charge the Tinley Park Five with conspiracy to three of the 37 counts against them, but charged them with 37 crimes, including a felony mob action charge. Each of the five ended up pleading guilty to the 337 counts against them, according to the Chicago Tribune, and were sentenced to prison, terms ranging between 3.5 to 6 years. Doxey also pointed to the protest-related conspiracy case in June 2020, when federal prosecutors in Ohio alleged two Pennsylvania men drove to join George Floyd demonstration in Cleveland, and with the sole intent corrupting what is supposed to be a peaceful protest. According to the Erie Times, a federal grand jury indicted the men, who are not alleged to be anti-fascist, on four counts each, including conspiracy to riot and cause civil disorder, and conspiracy to use fire to commit a felony. In the massive web of more than 700 cases related to January 6th, Capitol Riot federal prosecutors have brought conspiracy charges against nearly three dozen individuals, though they're not all accused of conspiring with each other. One of the January 6th conspiracy cases specifically targets individuals who allegedly belong to far-right anti-government Oath Keeper militia. January 9th. In announcing the charges against the defendants in the Pacific Beach case, prosecutors made clear they believe the violence on January 9th was largely one-sided. Video evidence analysis shows that overwhelmingly the violence in this incident was perpetrated by Antifa affiliates and not a mutual fray, with both sides crossing out of lawful First Amendment expression into riot and violence. Read a news release which District Attorney Summer. Not everyone agrees. Attorney Brian Pease, who sued the city of San Diego and at least 10 police officers on behalf of two clients who alleged police officers unlawfully cracked down on the counter-protesters while allowing the Trump supporters to continue marching undisturbed. The San Diego Police Department took a heavy-handed approach, only the anti-Trump side spraying peaceful protesters with pepper spray, shooting them with pepper balls, and beating them with batons. Pease alleged in a civil suit filed in the U.S. District Court. Meanwhile, SDPD officers also high-fived and chatted it up with the violent pro-Trump side, including some of them were later identified as being part of the assault on the U.S. Capitol. He said Friday that if police and prosecutors identified unlawful acts only on one side, that's certainly problematic. Online left-wing activists have also urged to be pro-Trump rally that day. Online left-wing activists have also argued that the pro-Trump rally that day was populated with members of far right-wing hate groups, members of Defend East County, a group banned from Facebook and from Election Day. A group banned from Facebook just before Election Day, when the site announced efforts to curb militarized social movements and violence, including conspiracy networks, and at least one marcher who did a Sieg Heil Nazi salute. It's in that context that the anti-fascists feel emboldened as a legitimate option. One of the Pacific Beach defendants remained large and wanted on $250,000 arrest warrant, while the rest were arrested and have since been released from custody. Additional hearings are scheduled for this week. Each of the defendants, if convicted, face up to 10 years and 8 months in prison. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
All right, so anybody can be anti-fascist. A lot of people have their reasons. Maybe they know someone who's been attacked by a fascist. Maybe someone they were in high school with became a fascist in their 20s. So there's a lot of people getting injured and killed by right-wing terrorist organizations, and they're not recognized by the Department of Justice as being terrorist organizations. Although this asymmetrical warfare against the general public has existed since 1977, when we saw the Greenboro Massacre take place, when the KKK killed about 5 communist labor organizers in North Carolina. That's when it began. Now, what we've seen here is that the white supremacist anti-Semitic killer at the Overland Park Jewish Center, his last station was there at Fort Bragg, and he had marches of KKK throughout the 70s of as many as 500 men in Klan uniforms, not necessarily white hoods, but their other dress outfit. So the government's failure to declare asymmetrical warfare has caused a big problem for 40 years. At the same time, we had an increase in mass incarceration, which is race-based. We've had increase in police killing black, brown, and indigenous people. Some activists tell me they can prove 100,000 black, brown, and indigenous people have been killed by police in the last 30 years. Because we don't know how many people are maimed, how many life-changing events. I've had activists here in Kansas City tell me that 1,200 people a year are maimed by police in Kansas City, where they're only killing, on the surface, 90 people or one person every 90 days is their average for the past 40 years since the Reagan administration. So there's a lot going on here, and for a lot of us focusing on mass incarceration and the profit margin and the corruption at the county jail level, all these things are playing out, and it's phenomenal how many people have become prison abolitionists in the past 4 or 5 years. So there is a movement building, and I'm glad everybody is being a part of it. And Mike, there's another clip, number 22, after this last one. And it's about the J20 trial in Washington, D.C., when they separated the IWW, and they tried the IWW together at the J20 trial. So we're seeing elements 22? From the red. Yeah.
Okay, I have. Yeah, there's okay.
This goes back to the Huns, the Red Scare from after World War II, after World War I. I'm sorry. The Palmer Raids, the Sedition Act, these types of things are starting to reoccur. And go ahead and play that one about, and we'll talk a little bit more about the J20 and look inside what to expect.
All right, I think we played it, but okay, all right, I'll try it. All right.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Experts say San Diego case likely first to use conspiracy charges against Antifa.
Okay.
San Diego Union Tribune, October 11th, 2021. Alex Riggin report.
Sorry. I'll try it there.
No, okay.
Sorry about that.
But that's all right. No, that's fine.
I want to add something. Yeah. Just released on Christmas Day, an article on thiscan'thishappening.net. Dave Lindorf wrote an article. It just happened. When was it? It was just a day or so ago. The Los Angeles Police Department murdered the headline of the article at TCBA, thiscan'thishappening.net, is the Los Angeles Police Department murder of a 14-year-old girl is an ugly illustration of America's wars coming home. That's the headline. But the story behind it that Lindorf writes about, he says it's a shooting death by the Los Angeles police of a 14-year-old Valentina on the name Orellana Peralta, who died in a changing room of a Burlington outlet store while with her mother, trying on a dress for her coming 15th birthday celebration. And the girl, like it says, was in a changing room and with her mother, and the police stormed the store. And it's largely an opinion piece, but Lindorf takes it apart. And he said, quoting the police officials, that say that the police were called because a man was attacking a store customer with a, quote, heavy-duty, unquote, bike lock and, quote, threatening to destroy store property, unquote. That in itself, this is Lindorf writing, that in itself doesn't sound terribly scary or grounds for the use of police firearms, especially with three officers on the scene at the time. There were also reports of shots fired, the police claim, but even if that were the case, and no gun was recovered from the attacker, who was also killed by the police bullets, nor were there any reports police or had a gun in his hand when he was killed. Lindorf writes, police should not be excused for firing their weapons in self-defense or to put a stop to a situation in a situation where there are crowds of people in the potential line of fire. I guess the store was, you know, was crowded with Christmas shoppers, and here comes these cops coming in. This guy's, you know, beating another store customer, and they kill him, and the bullets kill the young 14-year-old girl getting her birthday dress. So this is really, I mean, this is just weird. Lindorf later equates this about police firing, because the bullets went through the changing room walls and killed this young girl. He equates this to the Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky last year, which is a similar raid, and the cops are totally exonerated, where they fired fired shots through an opaque door during a no-knock house break-in to make arrests for or home searches. And he points out that, you know, they were exonerated by the prosecutors, the cops were, quote, just doing their job, unquote, and they refused to indict the police. The officers involved in Breonna Taylor's Louisville, Kentucky thing last year. So he says it's even worse, this latest killing of this young girl in a changing room in a Burlington outlet store is even worse than shooting through an apartment door. He writes, firing a police weapon in a crowded store in any perhaps, and I say perhaps, a hostage situation where a gunman is holding a gun to a captive's head has to be completely unacceptable. And there is no indication at all that this latest killing involved anything like that. He editorializes, just once, I'd like to see a police officer who murders a child like this just turn his or her gun and badge in, admit to having committed an inexcusable atrocity, and not try to lawyer her or his way out of trouble and hang on to a job as a cop. And he says he's covered these kind of things since he worked as a police reporter in Los Angeles, you know, in the 1970s. And he says they introduced this American policing, the militarized policing concept of special weapons and tactics, which everybody knows now is called SWAT. The SWAT teams, a violent approach now widely adopted and grossly overused by law enforcement agencies all across the country. I reported during those years on all too many cases of LAPD murders of unarmed people, which usually resulted in no legal consequences for the officers involved. So I won't be surprised if we learn that it wasn't just one wild shot that was fired when Valentina was killed in Los Angeles this Christmas holiday. U.S. police have a propensity to fire multiple rounds in incidents like these, And often several cops will fire at once. If that turns out to be the case, we're lucky there were not more injuries and fatalities as a result of the unfortunate police arrival on the scene to, quote, rescue, unquote, the public from a deranged attacker swinging a bike lock. And that's not the end of the article, but that was it was published on Christmas Day at thiscan'tbehappening.net by Dave Lindorf. And, you know, I just want to, and I know this is really, we're closing up the show here, but I just wanted to throw this at you. I watched this show called 137 Shots, Carl, and it really shook me up. It was about the police reaction to a car backfire in outside the Cleveland, Ohio Police Department office center, and the police massed over 60 cars in hot pursuit of this really run-down car with a woman and a guy in it, and they ended up firing 137 shots into the car, killing both of them, and there was no gun. It was an engine backfire. The occupants of the car had a quote unquote criminal history of prostitution and drug abuse, and they just went crazy. The police department went crazy, and I remember reading about it because a notable incident in the conclusion of that where the cops shot these 137 shots, which is the name of the documentary, listeners. And I think it's on Netflix, was this one officer standing up and jumping up and down on the hood of the car after they'd already fired dozens and dozens of bullets into the car and emptying his machine pistol. You know, he shot like 45 times or 30 times into the front windshield of these people who were probably already dead. And it's just, I mean, I just wanted to give that as part of my contribution to your special Lynchmas show tonight. I'm just horrified at what I'm seeing going on. Sorry to interrupt your show, Carl.
Well, no. I read this. It was absolutely horrifying where the girl was changing. She was in the changing room. So she had absolutely nothing. What anti-police people are saying is Google LAPD gang. Google LAPD gang, and you're going to spend till 4 o'clock in the morning reading. And do y'all remember the FX TV had a show 15 years ago, and it was called I don't remember what it was called now, but it was about the LA Sheriff's Department, I think. Or LA police, and you know it's that gang they're finding still exists in the sheriff's department, and so LAPD gangs, black and brown and indigenous women are so oppressed, folks, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, and the treatment of women in prisons, even Topeka, Kansas. We have to try to get people to make contact with the survivors that come out of that prison. Because the women's prison in Topeka, I guarantee you, is a horror story. And Native people, black and brown, it's a free fire zone, and if you get caught, you know, even though that's a 2.26 round, when it hits, it kills. And yeah, I think we should have drug analysis right on the spot of these police, because I think a lot of them are on like steroids and performance enhancing drugs. And because they're insane. And anybody that remembers high school football, college football, and it was around those guys, You see the sidewalks just clear and let those dudes walk down the street. This is the same situation we're dealing with police forces all across America. And,
yeah.
And it's no less in the rural areas. So
I tend to agree.
It's an absolute nightmare. And I read the story just one time, and once I got to the, she was in the dressing room, and they shot from outside on the sidewalk through the glass, and it went into the dressing room. It was like, okay. I can only take so much horror on a, 48-hour thing. You know what I'm saying? Because like I've got to be able to sleep sometimes, and this is an absolute nightmare. And another thing that's coming to my mind, is Burlington Coat Factory. I think we're going to find a lot of prison-made products in Burlington Coat Factory. In fact, we're going to see a big tie-in to the CEOs that profit from mass incarceration. So we've had a couple things happen this week. We've had the Amazon factory in Edwardsville, Illinois. We've had Mayville, Kentucky, prisoners killed down there. It's an assault on the working class. And we have to understand, and the Knights of Labor knew this 140 years ago. It's like, and E.B. Du Bois would say, hey, we've got to freaking organize by class across racial boundaries. This is the only way we can win. The only way. So we have to organize the rank and file. And we have to understand what's expected of us. We have to be anti-racist. We have to be anti-sexist. We have to be anti-fascist. That is the three legs of the stool that we stand on. We have to be anti-fascist. We have to be anti-racist. We have to educate, agitate, and organize. And we've got decades of experience out there, and because of the internet, we're able to collate all this information, and we're finding even now Yale and Harvard has had to get on board with what's happening. I mean, you have your bourgeoisie now that thinks, oh, maybe we can still save capitalism, and it's like, let it go. Let it go, because as David Graeber shows, debt is only for enslavement of the working class. That's the only reason why they need it. So let it go. Just let capital. You know, it's going. Climate change has kicked its ass this week.
I know, it was 70 degrees yesterday, and it was like 64 today out here where I live. I can't believe it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because they're saying we're very soon going to have weather like Houston, Texas. So the weather just changed. It wasn't that much of a gradual change. The next 7 years is critical. And now with COVID and more people having time off and things like that, it has helped to energize the base, because we've walked away from identity politics and all the little things that were going on in D.C. that they got going in their head. With bipartisan politics.
Well, Jeff Bezos, I'll be real quick. You know, Jeff Bezos got off his first Blue Origin rocket flight. He took up one of the oldest women to be in space, and and got off that after he flew up there with her and a couple other people. When he got back, he gave Van Jones, a black man, $100 million for his community work. I mean, I don't know how to. And there's all these people that are, you know, I don't know how. I shouldn't say it, but that's just, it sort of bothers me because that's, you know, Van Jones, of course, cried when he got the money, and he was there to get it. But I mean, I just don't know, man. I don't know. The power of bribery and persuasion is so corrosive and corrupting, I think, even among many, many people who would normally be considered, quote, movement, quote, leaders. I don't know, brother. We got to close the show. I know that. So
Van Jones never did a damn thing for the Black Panther Party. Hear what I'm saying? Bezos never did a thing. Bezos comes out of Q. His parents came out of Q. They ran with Batista. Castro was about...
We're running out of time, brother, and I, Carl G. with the Abolitionist Hour, will be back next Saturday night, prime time. Thank you, Carl.
Happy Lincoln!
Up there for those streets paved with gold. Trouble runs through my veins. Trouble from heaven runs through my veins. To food stamps, buy beer in heaven, mama. But tell me that's why daddy got baptized. To food stamps, buy beers in heaven, mama. Or does Jesus turn water into wine? Trouble runs through my veins. 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 Trouble. Heaven runs through my veins. Will you ever grow old in heaven, mama? But tell me from that Oxycontin cold, will you ever grow old in heaven? God shoot dope. Trouble runs through my veins. 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 Trouble from heaven runs through my veins. Trouble 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 from heaven runs through my veins.